It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's been called the Day of Reckoning as more high-profile figures fall to allegations of sexual harassment. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Seems like years ago now when allegations of sexual harassment and assault were leveled at then-candidate Donald Trump, and then media mogul Harvey Weinstein was hit with allegations and the floodgates opened. Big stars like Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose were forced out. Scandal also took the political stage with the resignation of Senator Al Franken as well as Congressman John Conyers. But the Alabama Senate candidacy of Roy Moore brought the issue to a boil with allegations of assault against young teenage girls while he was in his 30s. And that has brought the country back to calls for the resignation of President Donald Trump, or at least a congressional investigation. In our studio this morning is Michelle Hughes. She is with the Life Crisis Center here in Salisbury. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, well, let me just ask you right out, should Donald Trump resign?
That's not a question for me to answer. Although I have some concerns about there not being due process in a lot of these cases. It's one thing if someone elects to resign rather than go through an ethics investigation, but it's something else again to just demand a resignation when there hasn't been any due process.
So what do you make of the whole discussion about sexual assault as it evolved out of the Roy Moore campaign, in which we had initially there was Republicans who backed away and then they went ahead and supported him. There was some talk about due process. What do you think that race told us about how we handle this?
There's a very interesting study that's actually has just been released last week about the partisan divide over how we handle allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault. And what the study says, and the Pew Charitable Trust has been doing some of the interpretation, but the study says that Democratic and Republican, there's a vast difference between how Democratic women and Republican women view this sexual harassment. But there is almost no difference in how Democratic men and Democratic women view it.
Explain.
Well, that most women who identify as Democrats view sexual harassment as a very serious issue and can identify it as such. And but the same thing is true of Democratic men.
And what about Republican women?
Republican women are much less likely by a factor of 35 or 40 points mm-hmm. to identify sexual harassment as an issue. Mm. And that's what you saw happen, I think, in the Alabama race, was that Republican women, and Alabama is a very Republican state, right. But the Republican women did not view that as a problem.
Why do you think that is? I mean, you've dealt with these kinds of issues. I mean, do you any sense why? I mean, I've talked to, matter of fact, I remember talking to a Republican woman the other day who did not quite understand why women didn't shut this kind of behavior down immediately. I mean,
well, the shutting down of that behavior is fine to say that, and many of us can and will do that, but. Sexual harassment is more about power and control than it is about sex. It's very much like rape. Rape is not about sex. It's about power and control and more anger than anything else. But when you're talking about sexual harassment, especially in the workplace, that's about power and control. What you almost always see is men who are in a position of power abusing that power for their own sexual gratification.
So one of the things that struck me about Senator Al Franken, who resigned over these allegations, was that this was a senator who was very strong when it came to supporting women's issues. As a matter of fact, I read, that he was actually excited about the idea of of exploring this issue and pushing this, and now he was obviously undone by it. How does one explain that sort of split screen, as it were?
Well, I think Al Franken is not a good example because the allegation of sexual harassment happened when he was a comedian and not when he was a U.S. senator.
Mm-hmm.
And that does make a huge difference.
In what sense?
In the sense that in the story that was told and the young woman who made the allegation, it was in the context of a part of a script, and she was uncomfortable with how he had insisted on rehearsing this entire thing rather than just making it, okay, this we'll do this as read. And that's a very different thing. As a comedian, and especially for a USO show, which is a very raunchy kind of deal anyway.
Right.
And I'm not making excuses for him because, you know, if someone feels uncomfortable, then it's an issue, regardless of what you've done. If the person to whom it's being done feels uncomfortable, then it's wrong. But at the same time, we're not talking about someone who as a part of his duties as a U.S. senator, did this.
Now, I understand one of the allegations that later came out was that he sort of cupped the rump, as it were, of a number of women.
Yeah.
What do you make of that thing?
I do not know. And I'm not going to make a judgment on it. You know? When people come out of the woodwork and they're not really specific kinds of allegations, that's a different ballgame. I mean, I certainly don't think of him in the same way that I think of John Conyers. Who apparently he felt that it was his due to be able to grab anybody he wanted.
Right. And yet, if you looked at his voting record.
He's great on women's issues.
He's
a hypocrite.
Is there some cultural thing that's going on with an individual like that?
What do you think happens is that these men suddenly, because of their position, they feel they're above the law.
Hmm.
And indeed, in Congress, they are, because the same laws don't apply to Congress as apply to the rest of us.
By the way, what do you make of the Congress struggling with how to deal with sexual harassment?
I think it's funny because for years, I know a lot of women who have worked in the Congress, and they all say the same thing. It is absolutely a cesspool when it comes to sexual harassment, and you have almost no way to make yourself whole. If you want to work in Congress, you almost have to put up with much of this.
I mean, is it just because it's so personality-driven and congressional members, of course, have absolute power almost virtually over the entire office? So that's, so there's little recourse. I mean, is it just that you're so dependent upon who likes you and who doesn't like you and whether or not somebody says something bad about you? I mean, is that really part of the heart of it, do you think?
Absolutely. And if you want to be close to the seat of power, that's what you have to do, apparently.
So, stepping back for a moment, what do you think of this discussion that's now going on about, I guess, gradations, I guess, for lack of a better word? That is that somebody who's kissed, who didn't want to be kissed, for example, that's different than somebody who was grabbed, which is some different who was, say, sexually assaulted. What is there a legitimacy to this kind of gradation, or can we get lost in the weeds?
Well, certainly there is legally.
Right.
There are legal distinctions. And I think we are getting lost in the weeds. Anybody who feels that they were somehow wronged, especially working in a congressional office, is now coming forward. And I don't know how we fix this. It should have been illegal all along, as it is everywhere else in the world, or in the United States. But, of course, then you look at the entertainment industry. And I have to tell you that this is really the tip of the iceberg, because we're not talking about maids in hotels who are 100% at the mercy of the guest in the hotel. And there was a story a few years ago about the head of the World Bank who was raping maids in hotels. And nothing, there was nothing done about it. You know, people, the further down the food chain you are, the more likely you are to be sexually harassed or sexually assaulted. And when we're talking about, you know, stars, Selma Hayek recently came out in a very powerful piece in the New York Times. Well, yeah, that's pretty awful. But if it can happen to Selma Hayek, imagine what happens to women who are maybe in this country illegally and who are working as a maid somewhere. And she is one. She's afraid to go to the media. She's afraid to go to the police. She is 100% at the mercy of these hotel guests.
Well, I was going to ask you because we're paying a lot of attention to the stars, and there seems we'll get a lot of notoriety. But as you move, as you say, down the food chain, I'm just wondering what kind of impact all of this is going to have, or whether or not we're just seeing sort of this sort of media frenzy that sort of happens. Maybe it'll pass as we go down the line, but that the famous, okay, maybe you can get some reckoning. But if you're down there in the office help or the regular person, do you think any of this is going to reach down to that level?
I hope so. I think that the awareness, first of all, that it's illegal. Hmm. Most women, I think, certainly of the previous generation, thought that it was their lot in life. And for many women still, they think that it's, you know, it's what men do. I heard people who said when we heard the Access Hollywood tape, who said, oh, it's locker room talk. That's the way men talk. Well, my husband doesn't talk that way. And my sons-in-law don't talk that way. You know, but there was that assumption that that's the way men talk. But most of the men I know don't talk that way. And I think that the younger generation, they're totally unused to this kind of thing. And so what I think is happening is that eventually we'll see less of this kind of behavior simply because younger women are not going to put up with it.
Do you think that the younger men are learning a different lesson than, say?
I would certainly hope so.
I don't know.
I think it's a real thing. Yeah. We just had, and we're going to have an ethics committee about this young congressman from Nevada,
mm-hmm.
who he's a first termer. He was seen as someone who was a real comer, but apparently he learned from his elders. And so, you know, there's going to be an ethics investigation of him, and he may not run again. You know, if these young men don't get their act together, we're going to lose a lot of talent because of their inability to control other things.
I was going to ask you, because whether or not the law has kept up with this sort of thing. I ran across, I think it was Chapel Hill attorney Laura Noble, who wrote that victims have to rely upon the federal law, which is vague, outdated, and often the interpretation by judges can be somewhat different. And
yes.
She says, quote, in some instances they found things not to be sexual harassment that I think a jury of your peers would clearly find to be sexual harassment. Things like being groped or someone trying to kiss you against your will, et cetera. Do we need to update our understanding of that law, or do we need new language to make it clearer, do you think? I mean, you deal with some of this yourself.
Yeah, the federal language is deliberately vague. And, I mean, you have to be able to prove that the conduct has the purpose or effect of unreasonably interfering with an individual's work performance or creating an intimidating, hostile, or offensive working environment. What does that mean? You know, I mean, it's subjective. It's completely subjective. And you have a judge, and most times these men will insist on it being heard by a judge rather than a jury because they are much more likely, A, to get a man,
right,
and B, whose view of the creation of an intimidating, hostile, or offensive work environment is narrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to prove one of these cases in court.
I mean, is it simply because you've got the vagueness of the language, and then whatever view the judge has, or even a jury for that matter, but the judge has, if it's a narrow view, then you're going to get one ruling. If it's a broader view, you'll get a different ruling. I mean, is that the
I think so.
Same basic problem?
But that's one of the problems. But I think even in the case of judges who would be more inclined to rule in your favor, the language is you have to prove, very, very narrow things. And there are times when, in order to get ahead, you need this person mm-hmm. who you have accused of sexual harassment. You need that person in order to approve you're getting another job. And it's difficult to be able to explain that to people, that, he's standing in the way of my getting another job when he's not on the search committee. It's just that the people in the office know that he doesn't want you to get the next job. Mira Sorvino, the actress, is mm-hmm. a perfect example. She refused Harvey Weinstein, and as a result, she got almost no work because she was under contract to the Weinstein brothers. And she just recently discovered during this current wave that, in fact, it was Harvey Weinstein who was keeping her from getting work. People would inquire about using her, and they shut it down.
It reminds me of the Anita Hill.
Yes.
In which Clarence Thomas, of course, she accused him of harassment. And people were puzzled by the fact, A, that she saw him again. I'm not sure if she worked for him again or not, but she certainly saw him as somebody that she wanted to keep in good graces. Well, at the same time, obviously, she had this problem. I mean, is that sort of the quintessential kind of case where you don't say anything, you get past this, you might want it, this person's good recommendation? I mean, is that the perfect case there?
That is the absolute perfect example, because she is a woman who, by all accounts, should have risen far. And because of the fact that she came forward and testified in a hearing that was held by all white men, and if you go back and look at that, at the video of that hearing, it's embarrassing. I mean, you really are embarrassed for the Congress of the United States because of the way that woman was treated. You've got, a whole panel of white men asking her just awful questions. And she acquitted herself extraordinarily well. But I'll tell you who did not, and that is Joe Biden.
What happened to him? Was it just...
He was the chair of the committee.
Right. So he had an initial responsibility.
And he had the responsibility to shut down some of the more egregious questioning. And he did not.
Hmm.
And I see the other day that he said that he owed her an apology, which is encouraging. But, she will be the chair of this commission that is looking into the way Hollywood deals with sexual harassment.
Right.
Yeah.
An ironic thing.
An extraordinarily ironic thing.
We're also seeing sort of this conservative backlash, at least certainly surrounding, of course, Donald Trump. I guess Sean Hannity is probably the foremost image here. He says many women who report sexual harassment will like to make money. Then I think one of his latest things is he compared the uncertainty to allegations.
Sean Hannity likes to make money.
That's... Or he compares it to the Duke lacrosse thing, or Michael Brown, or George Zimmerman, Freddie Gray. It's uncertainty. What do you make of this backlash? I mean, he's sort of like the lead character,
yeah.
But there are a lot of other folks too.
Well, in life, there is very little that is absolutely black and white. And Sean Hannity has made his reputation and his fortune in taking a very small bit of gray and blowing it out of proportion. Because he, like most Americans, likes things to be in black and white. But they aren't. And it's a very difficult thing, I think, for there to be a total black and white. And they'll say things like, well, why did you see him again? Well, you saw him again because he was absolutely necessary for your job, you know. And but to make the take these tiny things and make them blow them out of proportion, and I have to say that the other side is no better at doing that. But there are it's the whole thing with this Roy Moore thing.
Mm-hmm.
There is no place in this country where it is legal to have any sexual contact with a 14-year-old girl.
Hmm.
No place. And to say things like to compare Roy Moore to Jesus Christ is way beyond the pale. And you, when you start to do things like that, I think you lose some credibility because you've gone too far.
Let me ask you this, because I'm reminded of Bill Clinton, okay?
Yes, all are reminded of Bill Clinton.
And did progressives take his indiscretions too lightly? And then, because it goes beyond Monica Lewinsky. There was a history here. We can debate whether some was credibility as well as consensuality of these things. But nonetheless.
They happened.
They happened. I mean, did progressives I don't know whether to make a mistake, but
well,
did they?
I think, yes.
If this were Donald Trump, they would be all over it.
I think that it is the case that many progressives went a little too far in their defense of Bill Clinton. However, I would also say that it was a different time. I mean, we're not criticizing Jack Kennedy, and he was probably the worst of all of them. Because that was, you know, what Jack Kennedy did. And the Secret Service was complicit in that.
Right.
So I think we have to take each of these issues and put it in the context of the time in which they happened.
Which I guess the question is, shouldn't we have been as outraged? I mean, I know it was a different time, but certainly wasn't. That's acceptable,
know.
Right?
That's
a tough question.
That it wasn't. I think it was a more acceptable thing. And I think a part of the outrage with the Clinton thing was that was not the special prosecutor was supposed to be doing.
Right, right.
You know, it was investigation of Whitewater. And
right.
The only thing they could get him on was not wanting to admit that he was a philanderer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was a very different time, and I mean, I can't make a judgment about it, just like I couldn't make a judgment. I mean, everybody knows that FDR
right.
was quite a ladies' man.
Right.
So, you know, we can't make judgments on what happened because people were not as attuned to the issue.
Should we be as harsh with somebody in which events occurred a number of years back? 20, 30 years. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
I'm sure there were more
think,
people would argue, but that's a separate category. But
I
nonetheless,
think
yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think it's a very different kind of – it's very different. I mean, with Bill Clinton, we're talking 20 years ago.
Right.
You know, and it's a different generation almost. It is a different generation. So I think we have to be mindful of the context, you know. I mean, if John Conyers hadn't touched another woman in the last 20 years other than his wife, that would be fine. But he has, apparently, last month. So we have to be more – I think we have to temper our judgment. We can't judge what was acceptable 20 or 25 years ago based on what's acceptable now.
Do you think that looking at the politics, the political landscape for last year, do you think that all made – Hillary Clinton's candidacy more difficult given...
Oh, I don't think there's any question. Yeah. I don't think there's any question. You know, as to whether she would have won, she has too many negatives of her own.
Right, right.
But
that particular...
Certainly that was an issue. I mean, I noticed that during the debates when Trump would walk around behind her.
Right.
I noticed it right away. I thought it was horrible that... somebody that the moderator didn't say, you know, back off.
Right.
But, you know, people view those things differently, and you'd view them through different lenses. But I do think we are at a watershed moment where we can make women actually equal.
Right.
At this point in time, if this is handled correctly.
I mean, do you think in many ways that the changing in terms, particularly the attitudes of women in terms of how, whether they can speak out or not, do you think that's going to be the dynamic that drives this behavior out?
I certainly hope so. I absolutely hope so, because unless they do, women can't take their place in society, as equals in society.
Well, we speak with Michelle Hughes. She is with the Life Crisis Center here in Salisbury about the scandals. We'll see how it all works out, and maybe a day of reckoning. We'll see what the future holds. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Certainly.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Life on the Chesapeake Bay has been told through a new novel about a waterman and his daughter. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The novel Still Water Bending by Wendy Clark tells the story of Giants Arley Evans, a waterman on the Virginia Western Shore, and his daughter, Lily Ray, who comes home after he has a stroke. Wendy Clark is no stranger to the tales of those who plow the waters of the bay. She has written extensively about the region over the years, including becoming the executive editor for the Chesapeake Bay Magazine. In her novel, Clark captures the hard life of watermen and the tides of change that have swept over the region. And she's in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what inspired you, first of all, to write this novel? And then I understand you really, generally speaking, you're just writing nonfiction. You do lots of magazine work and so on. What spurred you to enter the world of fiction?
Well, I'd always wanted to write a novel. Everybody wants to write a novel, right?
Right.
And I, originally went to college thinking I was going to major in creative writing, and that's not how it turned out. And that's not how life turned out. So, I'd always wanted to do it, essentially. And when I found my subject, I started.
So what inspired you for these particular characters? I understand that you based some of it on some of the people you've known.
Yeah, the characters came about because of a story that I'd actually written for my first nonfiction book, which is called Window on the Chesapeake, which was published in 2002, I think, by the Mariners Museum. And that was a series of essays about the bay. And one of the essay subjects was a waterman down in Bayvon, Matthews County, Virginia, named Walter Coles Burroughs. And I spent the day with him pound net fishing. And, you know, I was going to just write a typical sort of profile story about him. But at the end of the day, when we came in off the water, he invited me into his kitchen to sit down and just talk. And he clearly didn't want me to leave, and he clearly just wanted to talk about sort of things other than fishing and his life. And he was very sad because he had lost his wife. And I came away from it just sort of compelled by the melancholy of the man. And so he sort of stuck in my head. And I wrote this profile story about him that did run in Chesapeake Bay Magazine. It was part of my book. Then it got picked up by a journal of creative nonfiction called River Teeth, won a bunch of awards. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever written. And then because I always wanted to write fiction, I knew about the Breadloaf Writers Conference in Middlebury, Vermont. And to me, that was Mount Olympus. You know, if you could get into Breadloaf, you know, you were writing with the gods. And so, but I had no fiction. And to apply, you have to submit a chapter of work that you're working on. And so I said to myself one day, thinking about it, well, why don't I just take that story, which is still very compelling to me, and turn it into a fiction? So I took that essay and I created, I basically fictionalized it a little bit. Completely rookie move, but it was enough to get me into Breadloaf. And then the story and the characters, you know, grew out of that.
So tell me, set up for our audience a little bit about what the story is, because it opens, I guess, with the Giants' stroke, and then obviously then shifts to his daughter. Set that up for us.
Well, Giants has been living in the same point on the same river for his whole life and his generations before him, his forefathers before him also. And he never wants to leave this place. It's who he is. It's what he is. But he has lost his wife. He has lost his young son. And when he lost his wife, his daughter was still pretty young. And he just kind of shut down and he could not be a real father to her. He pretty much emotionally abandoned her. As soon as she graduated high school, she left. And so he's been alone now for 14 years, living in this big old house and fishing every day and living his life. And so he kind of lives with ghosts. And so the story opens with him sort of giving some of this background, and he goes out fishing, and on the way in, he has this stroke. And then in the second chapter, we're introduced to his daughter, who's up in Maine. She's a journalist with the Associated Press, and she's pretty bitter, pretty guarded, walled-off human being. Not surprising, considering where she came from. She gets the call, you're his only kin, you have to come back and help. And so this is what makes the two of them collide again. She has to come back to Virginia, to this place that she never, ever wanted to go back to this man she never wanted to be around again. And it's how she copes with that and how he copes with her. And how they navigate that situation that the story unfolds.
Yeah, this is, you talk a little bit about, she thinks about how the area has changed, the region has changed. And you write that many of the new people would begin to want Ophelia to be something different than it was, all the while proclaiming how much they loved it for what it is. Tell me a little bit about that. It's almost as if the region becomes another character in this book.
The sense of place, I believe, is a primary character in this book. And I wanted it to be really alive to people the way it is for me. We've all seen it, right, on the Chesapeake and elsewhere, where you have a rural, beautiful community that lived sort of traditional ways, particularly on the bay. It has to do with living on the water and watermen's communities. And then as time has gone on and things have changed, these properties have become very valuable. Everybody wants to live on the water. And so, they're coming into these areas and they're paying top dollar for these homes, and property values are going up and people can't afford them, can't afford their taxes. So there's that enormous cultural shift going on. And part of the story is about how this community is managing or living with that cultural shift.
So, as a matter of fact, we see a little bit of that because there's at one point in the book where he's mining up these medical bills, and there's a real estate guy who comes by, sounds pretty slick, mm-hmm. Hey, you can solve all your problems.
That's right. He comes to her daughter. This real estate agent comes to her daughter and says, look, Pop's not in such good shape, and winter's long, and maybe the thing to do here is to sell off this piece of property, and you can take care of all the bills, and you can go live in Florida, and everything will be fine. And, of course, she is pretty practical, and she wants out. She wants to get everything solved so she can go back to Maine. So she starts entertaining this notion that, yeah, maybe this would work. And even if we just sold a little piece of it, that would work. And she broaches the subject with her father, who, of course, rejects it out of hand and says, this is my home. This is my place. Evanses have lived here for generations. And as long as I'm alive, that's only Evanses are going to live here. And so he digs in his heels about this. And becomes kind of another point of contention for them.
Yeah, is there a certain sense of denial about his current circumstance and the future, in the sense that obviously the bills are piling up? I think you note at one moment that he doesn't open up the mail. He doesn't open up these bills.
Right.
Is there a denial about what lies in front of him?
I think Gines is afraid. Gines is he's had a pretty tough life, and everything he's loved has slipped away, and that includes his home. And so the idea that he would have to give up this last piece, this actual dirt, the dock, the water, the house, all the ghosts, that scares him very badly. And so Yeah, I think he's in deep denial about what's happening to himself physically. You know, he's a powerful man who's been rendered almost helpless. That scares him. What's going to happen in the future scares him. There's a exchange when he's in the rehab center and he ends up being a roomie with this other fellow who was also he was in the Menhaden fleet for many years. His name was Linwood, and he sort of watches what happens with Linwood and swears that that's not going to be his fate. You know, he's not going to allow himself to just be shuffled off to some home somewhere and stuck in a corner to die. So he's looking at the end of his life, and he's scared. Yeah.
Is in some ways, is this some of these themes are really sort of this disappearance of a way of life? Do you think?
Yeah. I mean, yes. And as the story goes on, you know, it's told in two voices. It's told in Jines's voice and it's told in Lily's voice, two points of view that alternate back and forth. And as the story develops, Lily's voice starts to take over. Hers becomes more dominant. Jines's starts to vanish. And that's sort of, you know, a metaphor for the entire story. He's going away and his world is kind of going away. And, She's gonna step into his place.
Now they do seem to reach out to one another when they start building the skiff. Who's motivating that? I mean, whose idea is that? Are they both going towards that object at the same point, or is somebody initiating it? How do you?
Well, the idea. You know, the concept that I wanted to get across here is something that I've actually seen happen where, you know, when you have two people who have a very complicated, difficult relationship and they reach a point where they just can't even talk to each other, there's just so much baggage in the room. And that's sort of where they are right when the story begins. That's where they are. And yet, if two people can find a common language outside of that, I've seen them be able to communicate around all of that baggage. You know, they come in from a different point of view. They're focusing on something else. And it's kind of miraculous when it can happen because it gives you a place to begin to talk again. So I wanted to illustrate that. And the fact that Jines is a boat builder also provided the avenue to do that. The idea behind building the skiff, he was going to build the skiff years ago, but, you know, he just didn't get around to it. And then one night out in the shed, he's gone out to the shed and he's just sitting there because he can't sleep. And she comes out looking for him and, you know, they start talking and she starts rooting around and she finds this pile of this extraordinary stack of beautiful cedar hiding under a tarp. And she says, "What's this for?" And he says, "That was going to be for a skiff." And she says, "Well, why don't you build it?" And so the idea was sort of hers to keep him busy because at this point he can't go fishing anymore. He's too sick. But he can't just, you know, as he says, "I can't just sit here and knit doilies." So, you know, he's got to work with his hands. So her concept was, "Why don't you go build it?" He goes out in the shop to try, you know, he starts thinking about it and he says, "Maybe not such a bad idea after all." And he goes out into the shop to try and realizes that he's going to need help. And so he has to ask her because she's the only person that he can ask. And she acquiesces. So they end up finding this common project, common ground in this shed around building the skiff. And that's where they begin to find a language they can speak together.
What do you think that he learns from that experience? What does he get out of this joint effort? Because at one point she's basically now doing most of the work. He's kind of sitting there.
Yeah. For me, you know, for Jines is honoring his past, building this skiff. You know, he's honoring everything that he cares the most about and his ability, his skill, which I should mention, all of those parts of the book are pretty precisely accurate because I spent a lot of time with a boat builder in Reedville named George Butler, who let me be a fly on his wall in his shop and watch him build this skiff. So the process, the terminology, the method, even the planer that figures in here was in his shop. You know, what I think Jines gets out of it is that Jines is honoring this tradition. He's honoring his people. He's honoring his family. He's honoring his past. And what Lily gets out of it is interesting. She begins to respect something more, I think, about her dad. She begins to understand better the burden of time upon him.
Oh, it's also, by the way, you should have another character, which is Jamie Cockrell. He enters her life. He's already been married and I assume, guess, divorced, although he has a young child named Belle. What role do you see him playing in this transition that Lily seems to be making?
Well, Jamie and Lily grew up together. They were best friends growing up. And actually, when Gines wasn't a very good dad, Lily spent a lot of time living in Jamie's house, sort of being nurtured by Jamie's mom, Mary Virginia, who's a pretty funny character in and of herself. So part of her reluctance to come back to Ophelia has to do with seeing Jamie again, because she, you know, probably has loved him her whole life. But, you know, she walked away. She pulled herself away from him because as she grew older, became a teenager, it embarrassed her, you know, her situation. She felt kind of embarrassed and kind of mortified by the fact that she was kind of this outcast. So, you know, when she comes back, she's intrigued to see him again, but also very nervous about seeing him again. And I guess the role that, you know, that Jamie plays, besides being, you know, this gorgeous, right, handsome young waterman, is that fact that he actually does want to continue the life. He wants to be a waterman, and not many young people do want to be watermen anymore, but he loves the life. He loves being out on the, you know, on the river, on the bay. He doesn't have the opportunity to do it because his father, who was a waterman and owned the licenses, is no longer around. And so Lily comes up with this idea. Once Gines can't go out on the water anymore, she says, you know, maybe you should ask Gines if you could lease the Jenny Ray, his boat, and fish his traps, which at first seems like a crazy idea. But he asks and Gines says yes. So he represents to me, you know, obviously a potential future of someone who pays homage and respects, you know, the way of life, and wants to figure out a way to make it work going forward, is not willing to just walk away from this community and this way of life.
And then, of course, we have Kenneth Raley, who has worked with Gines, I guess, for many, many years, and he's left out in the cold. He seems like the, you know, as if somehow his efforts are not appreciated. And how does he fit it? How does he fit into this in that sense? And do we get any sense about how he resolves that with the idea that, okay, well, it's Jamie's the guy, not me?
From Kenneth?
Yeah. Or does he accept it at all?
I think Kenneth in the end does accept it, and he accepts it because he realizes that he was never willing to be responsible enough to earn the trust necessary for someone like Gines to give him his whole life, his boat that he built, you know, his licenses, everything. I mean, Kenneth has worked with Gines for a long time, but he's got an alcohol problem. He's not very trustworthy, and he's loyal, but he's not very trustworthy, and they're two different things. And Gines is unwilling to, you know, Gines feels that Kenneth is too willing to take the shortcut. He's not willing to really care deeply about something. And, you know, at his core, Gines cares deeply, deeply, deeply about these things. So he's not going to just hand it off to Kenneth.
And of course, we have Belle. What do you think she represents? I mean, she's very precocious and...
Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, Belle for me is, I kind of modeled her a little bit after my daughter.
Oh, okay.
Who was very precocious. And when I was writing the book, you know, she was, I guess, about this age, maybe a little bit younger. You know, I love the idea of young people who can just sort of see through adults' mess and sort of cut right to the heart of things. And Belle has this capability. It's something that Lily really needs. And Lily also realizes by spending time with Belle that actually maybe she's not so closed off as she thinks she is. I mean, one of the things that Jamie says to her is, you know, when he had Belle, his heart cracked wide open. And that's okay. And that's, you know, to be a full human being, you have to allow that to happen to yourself. And it's Lily's burden to learn this. I mean, that's part of, you know, her journey in the story is essentially learning this, allowing her heart to be cracked open, allowing pain back in, and also joy. So Belle represents that idea.
Well, because one of the things that struck me was this idea of perfection. I think there's at one point Giants had yearned for something perfect that he had grasped it so briefly and then lost it before he understood the simple truth that it didn't need to be, that is, need to be perfect. And Lily seems to be come to this same conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, Lily's really mad at him. I mean, she's got a pretty big chip on her shoulder. You know, she's got a little bit of the victim thing going on. You know, my youth was horrible. My father was a freak and horrible man and cold. And she says to Jamie at one point, I would have been better off, or no, not Jamie, another character, I would have been better off being raised by a dog pack. You know, she really has to, I'm sorry, I kind of lost the track of that.
That's right. But I mean, this whole idea about searching for perfection.
Yeah.
For,
yeah, like she, you know, she had this idea in her head about what a father-daughter relationship should be. You know, what you should have been this. It's, you know, and it's sort of about expectations and what we expect of people versus what they can actually deliver. And in the end, you know, she very much wants Giants to do a particular thing, to go in a particular direction, and he simply can't. And she has to accept that and still realize that, you know, she loves the man and he loves her and it's okay.
Because, as a matter of fact, there's, I think, one moment where they're building the boat and basically he's telling her, she's realizing that there's this beauty in the imperfection of the wood itself.
Right. There's an area in the boat where she's made a mistake. She was really angry with him. She's having this discussion again about selling the land and, you know, you have to come. You know, she's trying to make her case to him. He's discovered now that she actually went behind his back.
Right.
And she went far enough with this realtor to have a perk test done on a piece of, you know, land off to the side. And she's sort of progressing with this idea, thinking that if she gets the ball rolling far enough, then she presents it to Giants and he can't say no. Which, of course, is not what happens. You know, Giants is no fool. He figures it out and he says, no, you know, no, I'm not budging on this. I never was going to budge on it. And at that point, she's trying to fit this particular piece in the skiff and she's getting all distracted and she makes a mistake and it's no good. And she starts to rail against this, you know, about I have to take it out. I have to fix it. And he said, no, no. He's like, we can fix this. This is not, it's okay. It's okay that it's not perfect. You know, we can work with this. And that's part of what she's learning.
And it seems to me that translates into the relationships. She realizes that's what's, that you don't have perfect relationships.
Right. It's impossible.
So how do we assess then the relationship between her and Jamie? Is that going to be a perfect relationship? I know. I'm asking what happens
next. What happens
right?
next? You know, I don't know. I don't know. I think it's going to be a pretty great relationship, but I don't think any relationship is perfect. And I really think that, you know, as adults, we all have to understand that we're flawed. You know, human beings are flawed. And I think loving somebody is understanding the flaws and accepting the flaws and then working together on other things. So I think that's what she's going to have to do.
So, do you see this way of life disappearing? I mean, you've written about it a lot. Certainly on the Western Shore, we see it's certainly true here on the Eastern Shore. Deal Island, I think, is one of those classic examples where you see
this,
the young people don't stay, although there are some people, for instance, the Skipjacks, you know, there are some young people who are picking up the trade, but a lot of them are just leaving. It's just too hard of a life.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's up against enormous challenges, not the least financial.
Right.
You know, trying to maintain any kind of boat is expensive. Trying to maintain a working boat is expensive. As watermen are at the whim of nature, and any occupation that's at the whim of nature, whether you're a farmer or a waterman, means that you're taking a risk every time every season. I don't know. You know, I'm not going to sit here and be the one to say, yes, it's all going away. I certainly feel like in my time on the Chesapeake, I've seen enormous change in the nature of the waterfront, even just in marinas and how they're run. And, certainly in communities like Rock Hall, that used to be almost all watermen and is now pretty much almost all recreational. When I first came back to Annapolis in 1989, in the wintertime, in City Dock, all the oyster tonguing boats would be docked in there in the wintertime. They allowed them to all raft up along the City Dock in the winter, and it was a beautiful thing. You know, you'd come through town and it'd be snowing, and there'd be all these beautiful dead rise work boats, which I just love. I mean, they're just gorgeous boats. And that gives you a sense of place, you know, of what this place values. Well, that's gone. They're not the work boats aren't in City Dock anymore ever. I think there's one working dead rise coming out of that area now. And City Dock is full of recreational boats now. So to me, that's a very visual representation of the cultural shift that's taken place even just in the last 25 years in Annapolis.
Do you think we've lost something?
Yeah.
What do you think that is? I say that because I know I said this actually to somebody else who had done something on the skipjack. And one of the things that struck me coming from the West is that the watermen remind me of cowboys. That is that they're extremely independent. They've got their horse. They go from drive to drive. They're very, very independent individuals. And it seemed to me that when I look out particularly at the watermen and particularly the skipjack and skipjack captains, that they seem to have the same kind of characteristics.
Yeah, I think I suffer from a danger of being nostalgic about yeah. stuff like this. And so, I know that life is brutally hard. Mm-hmm. The reality is it's brutally hard. It's worth it to people. Obviously. And, you know, Gines is an interesting character because even though he's kind of this hard-shelled, hardcore waterman, he absolutely loves nature. He's curious about it. The idea of being a person of water and sky is very natural to him. And I think, I don't know if all watermen feel that way. Although, I've certainly read a lot about, how it's important to them to be able to be out there every day, to see that horizon, to be part of that world. Do I think the Chesapeake Bay as a larger community is losing something valuable? Yeah, I definitely do. I do. I know I can suffer from nostalgia, but I do feel that way. I don't want it to become corporate and plastic. I want it to remain, parts of it at least, mm-hmm. I hope can remain sort of more traditional and respectful of these ways of life that are absolutely part of what makes the Bay what it is.
But you obviously spent some time on the water with watermen and so on. What kind of personal feel do you get about being out there?
You mean me out
yeah.
there?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I may, and perhaps, you know.
Yeah, well, I grew up on the water, okay. Not as a waterman, of course, not in a right. waterman's family, but I'm one of those recreational people. my parents had a boat on the Sassafras River from when I was a little kid, and we were what's called the Pennsylvania Navy. Every weekend, the Pennsylvania Navy descends upon the northern Chesapeake and comes into all the marinas. And so we're part of the problem, I suppose, if you could call it that. Being on the Chesapeake Bay, being in part of everything that makes it what it is from an ecological standpoint. Its natural beauty has always been a huge part of my life. So, and it's always played, it's always been an enormous part of my writing. I'm not executive editor of Chesapeake Bay Magazine anymore.
Right.
That's been a while back, but I still write columns for them on occasion. And I still write about the bay all the time. And it's always centered in the physical beauty of the bay, the natural beauty of the bay. I just feel much better when I'm out there.
Is there another book? Another fictional book?
People have asked me if I'd write a sequel.
That's true, too.
And,
what happened to Jamie and Lily, right?
Right. You know, I don't even know if I have that in me.
What kind of difference was there in writing a book like this, which basically, I mean, you've got a lot of information or experiences you're drawing upon, as opposed to, say, something that's nonfiction, which, okay, you go, you get all the dates
right.
and figures. I mean,
Well, you know, parts of this book, I approached it very much as nonfiction. Mm. For instance, the boat building part,
right.
The pound fishing part, any part that had to do specifically with a specific sort of tradition or craft that I wanted to describe was very much I approached it from a nonfiction point of view. That's why I spent all that time with George Butler. I wanted to make sure, you know, I got it right. But writing fiction is hard. I find it to be sort of like jumping off a cliff every morning. And sometimes it's really exciting because some things will, you know, fall into place and you just can't believe how that happened. But it took a lot of time. I actually left the magazine, and my husband, who was running, owned a boatyard at that time, said to me, you know, the kids were little. He said, why don't you go ahead and leave the magazine? I'll take care of stuff, and you work on this book, which was extraordinary of him to do that. So I would get up in the morning. I'd take the kids to school, to elementary school, and then I'd come home, and I'd sit down for 4 or 5 hours, whatever the period of time it was, and I would just work on it. I took classes at the Writer Center in Bethesda and learned a lot there. I did get to go to Breadloaf twice and learned an enormous amount there. And then I developed a very small writers group of 3 other writers. One was a Breadloaf alum, and 2 I met through the Writer Center, and we would meet once a month in D.C. and critique each other's work. So they basically, you know, they helped this novel be born because they, from the start to the finish, they were part of it. Fiction writing is a pretty lonely process, so I enjoyed having people to tell me I wasn't crazy and that what I was doing was okay.
And this particular book, it's the kind of book I like, is that the characters, but you really do get a sense of what's going on inside their head. I mean, how was that more difficult, do you think? I mean, how difficult was that to get in? Because there was a lot of layering of, you know, from moment to moment and sort of looking at this, at the world through these people's eyes.
Yeah. Gines and his point of view and his voice was very strong in me right from the beginning. And that's probably because the core of the story came from that original interview, which, by the way, I should say that Walter Colesbrose was a much nicer man than Gines.
Okay, but put that on the record.
Yeah. You know, he had the only thing they had in common was that they, in the area that they lived, what they did for a living, right. And the fact that they'd both lost their wives. The first version of the book, his voice was a lot stronger and his motivation seemed quite clear to me. Lily's not so much. She was a little too simple when I first wrote it. So when I came back to it, a couple of years later, mm-hmm. I felt like I had learned some things and I needed to change the ending a little bit. And I better understood her and her motivation. The other thing that I did was I had the first draft of the novel coached by a woman I met at the Writer Center, a teacher there named Barbara Estman. And she's a terrific writer, a terrific coach. And she also felt that the character of Lily needed some more explanation. You know, why is she doing what she's doing? So when I came back to rewrite, I focused more on Lily and her voice. And as I got to know her better, her motivations became more clear.
How long, by the way, did it take you to write it?
The initial draft, I have sort of been thinking back on it now, and I'm going to say it was probably 2 years,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little bit more than that. of pretty consistent work. And then I put it away for about 3 years because my family and I took off on our boat and went sailing full time for 4.5 years. So I was really busy navigating, homeschooling, you know, doing all that stuff, cooking.
Right.
But then the last year that we were out, a contest, I learned about a contest, a creative writing contest for unpublished first novels. And I thought, maybe I could submit it.
Right.
And at the same time, I knew, and that was sort of what prompted me to go back through what Barbara had said, go back about how I was thinking about Lily. And again, my husband said, okay, I'll take care of homeschool and the kids. You use that time to go back and do the rewrite. So that's what I did. And so I guess if you add that time into it, you know, that was another year.
Another year.
By the time, I don't think I can really even quantify it.
It's a long process.
Yeah. And, you know, I would love to say that I could become a full-time fiction writer. I'm not sure it's my strongest writing, you know. It's a way for me as a writer to flex a lot of muscles, new ones, try something I've never done, challenge myself. I'm doing the same thing with poetry now. So I'm really enjoying that. It's the exact opposite of all these words.
Right. It's just
highly compressed.
Concise. That's right.
Yeah. I think I'm kind of prosed out for a while. So poetry's been really, really great. But again, it's the same idea. You know, I feel like as a writer, it's really good to try different things all the time and challenge yourself.
We've been speaking with Wendy Clark. She is author of a new novel called Stillwater Bending, about a waterman and his daughter. We do appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.